in the current draft on Friday, and then the following week, so in less than 2 weeks, we hope to get out to you this kind of like bigger kind of cumulative update that will cover both the remaining general part provisions in Chapter 3, which is the main like conspiracy solicitation, as well as then at the same time we'll be putting out these offenses against persons, property offenses, you know, basically updates for all the special part offenses. And haven't fully figured out, it partly depends on scheduling out the rest of the summer. I want to give you guys as much time as possible, but increasingly as the end becomes a little bit more in focus, time becomes short. So I think what we'll probably do is kind of stagger it so that what you'll get, again, probably like a week from Monday, week and a half to 2 weeks from now, after this current batch is in, it'll be that whole big package of stuff with, for instance, a deadline of, so you get everything, but only you'll have 4 weeks to do, like, for instance, the general part first, get back comments on that. And then another 4 weeks after that might be the deadline for the next chunk of what was given. So, like, you'll have it in your hands, because I know, like, you know, at least some of the agencies, like, kind of divided up, right? So that might facilitate that and actually give some more time for the people who are doing this chunk that isn't due for 8 weeks from the time you get it, versus over here it's going to be 4 weeks from the time you get it for like the general part, for instance. So that, yeah.
But
yeah.
The chunks will move in order, right? So like, it's not divided up any more than us, but at least like if a person's moving through from page 1 to page 5,000,
The big thing is the general part, right? Like, that will be first, and that, you know, kind of logically, sequentially, you want to kind of, like, address, see any changes there before you hit the special part. And even in the special part, it'll be like, oh, offenses against persons. Let's do that together, right? And, like, the deadline for that will be together, even if it ends up being a little bit different for property offenses. And, yeah, so it's going to be a lot. Won't lie, just volume-wise. But like this last batch, we have kind of sorted it out so that there'll be like a kind of a disposition of comments. You know, here's what we heard before, and you know, kind of the treatment of that. So that'll hopefully be a helpful kind of, you know, shorthand guide for reviewing. As always, happy to meet the folks. You know, to do what we can to kind of facilitate your review. Yeah, what else to say? We obviously, or perhaps not obviously, but we will be having, you know, some staff taking lead here. And so, particularly with respect to general provisions, and, I guess that's the main thing where, like, to the extent you have questions, the sooner you can front load them, probably the better, and we'll just address them as best we can. You know, we'll as we can. Let's see, what else? The other thing I just wanted to mention, last thing, and then I'll turn it over to Michael for today's if there's questions on, you know, the basically the chapter 2, the general part that's out for review now. Last thing is just to mention again that we're, as we get out this kind of cumulative update, a lot of material for you to review, you know, staff, that is in the office still for the, you know, coming months is going to be kind of focusing on weapon and drug offenses in particular. So, you know, always, you know, kind of say, but just want to put out there again, if there's a particular something up front you want to flag for us, we'll let us know. If not, we'll just go forward and we'll be putting out, you know, we aim to get the first draft of that out this summer, right? Kind of after this BFR. This cumulative update is, yeah. Don't ask for
review?
That.
It is a big fucking review.
No, it's a big fall review. It's a big fall review.
In my mind.
It started this fall. We were doing a big fall review, and so we called it a BFR. Anyway, so that's what we've been working on, is our big review. And
it's true. He's from Nebraska. True. He's from Nebraska. Like, it's
that's
very...
Right. That's right.
Very wholesome.
Very seasonal. Very wholesome.
Yeah.
So, we'll as soon as we finish that, we'll be putting out the kind of the first draft for weapon and drug offenses. And so that's the next thing. Just put that on the horizon. With that, I think I'm going to step out for this this council here and leave it to Michael. And you know, again, I think you know we've had some discussions. Questions already people have had on some of this material. So you know, it's always to the staff jokingly, it may be a short meeting, maybe a long meeting. Either way, look forward to your comments and next week. And then yeah, the cumulative update we'll go forward with as well. Turn over to Michael.
Yes.
Okay.
Time to
try
this
one again.
Yep.
Sorry.
Nope. But I'll let Michael go ahead and start us up here while I see if I can pull up on the screen.
So I'm just here to answer questions. I don't have any affirmative agenda. So, you know, if any folks have any questions, feel free to raise them.
I have one to start it off.
Sure.
I'm still hooked up on trying to picture how the government proves blameworthiness. Mm-hmm. So if we could just go through that. In other words, how that actually is proven in court. Not how it's argued, but we have to meet the, right? We have to prove blameworthiness
right. In
order to get a conviction. I'm trying to figure out from the footnotes and everything how that actually happened.
So let me ask you this. Did you feel like you had a good sense of the gross deviation standard, and this is different, or just so I understand the scope of what you're asking, right? So the revision was we took the sort of legalistic gross deviation language and based on what the MPC drafters basically intended to communicate, came up with language that we've thought more clearly expressed that. Is the question as to like under both?
I guess it's both.
It's both.
Yeah, I don't have a quibble with the change of the language from more from more legalistic to less. But I'm trying to picture a jury instruction. I'm trying to picture how one actually argues or proves it. I guess would be the point. When to me there seems to be a moralistic element to it, if that's the right word.
Right. Yeah. In the same way.
So how do you prove that, or disprove, or
So it's in the same way that reasonableness is used throughout, like the criminal law, right? I mean, the idea that there's like moralistic or normative standards incorporated. I mean, that kind of pervades all different areas. Anytime someone has to act reasonably, or there's a question of reasonableness, self-defense, etc. Right. That's kind of like a quote-unquote moralistic evaluation. But I guess the best place to start would just be with the language, right? So let's just look at the definition of recklessness. The prong B as to a result element.
Hold on, let me get that.
Sure.
We'll try to get it on the screen right now.
So the reads, the risk is of such a nature and degree that considering the nature and purpose of the person's conduct and the circumstances known to the person's conscious disregard of that risk is clearly blameworthy. So the sort of key factors there are, what was the nature and degree of the risk? What was the nature and purpose of the person's conduct? And what were the circumstances known to the person? And based upon an evaluation of those factors, do you find, has the government proven that the person's conduct or disregard of the risk was clearly blameworthy? There's a, on pages.
It's a page 35.
Okay.
Pages, I believe it's 45 and 46. Hold on a second. So there's like, two full examples where the commentary goes through a clear blameworthiness analysis in a reckless, in a damage to property hypothetical. It's on page 44.
Seeing the language in place is at page 35, not the expression.
So I just read the language and noted the factors that are explicitly stated in the statutory language. Janu, can you go to page 44 mm-hmm. of the report?
To the top of the page, sure.
Yeah, I mean, so Dave, there's like three paragraphs there which go through explicitly every sort of dimension how this would be proven. Do you want to maybe read that? Let me know if you have any questions on that. You can start the second paragraph with, for example.
I thought it was good.
So, yeah, let's say the second is the extent to which the driver's decisions enter the intersection was intended to further a legitimate societal objective.
Sure.
I guess I'm still having trouble.
Yeah, sure. Let's go to the footnote.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it's probably the example of...
No, so look at the footnote. Sort of like just go to the footnote right there.
To the hospital or something.
Yeah, exactly.
No, and that I get if it's an emergency. But in a typical situation, what is the society?
Right, there's none.
Of a driver
there's none.
Going into it? And I, again, it's a jury instruction. I was thinking about how I explain that distinction to somebody who has no idea what we're talking about.
Well, the no. So, okay, so
because
this is
once it's listed in there, a societal objective, then we have to explain it.
Right, but hold. Yeah, so, Dave, this is the same issue we went through on de minimis, right?
Okay.
Right. It is the judge can decide, as a matter of law, that something is not a legitimate societal objective. In the same way, and this is the exact conversation we had in the context of de minimis, right? So, right, it's like what Laura said, right? So. The example of what a legitimate societal objective would be is given in footnote 36, for example, that the thought that the person entering the intersection thought that he or she would avoid a more harmful crash with an oncoming school bus or get a passenger suffering from what would be a heart attack, the hospital's expeditions. So you understand that?
No, I got it when it should apply.
Right.
My problem is trying to explain to somebody when it shouldn't apply.
Yeah.
Because racing into the intersection because you're trying to get home to see the start of the football game isn't a legitimate societal interest.
But I don't know
and you're not going to let us argue it because the judge is going to be like, you're kidding me. That's
right.
What you're trying?
Well, that makes sense. But all I'll know as a prosecutor is that somebody was racing into the intersection. I might have some concept if the person's pregnant and bleeding. But other than that, how would we be able to show... what it is, right? It's our burden to prove why they were racing into the intersection, isn't it?
No, you're proving no. They raced into the intersection.
You're showing this. You're going to argue that they raced in the intersection.
And there's no pregnant person in the car.
That when they did so, they were aware of a risk that they would crash into another vehicle. And you'll say that based upon the facts, we have no reason to conclude that this was for any legitimate societal objective.
Okay.
Does that? It was,
yeah.
Yeah.
No.
Okay. Any other questions?
So I think your question is, when we were at the jury, we're in the Red Book Committee, and we are drafting instructions, then we have to provide in the commentary some sort of explanation of legitimate societal objective.
Can you go back to
well,
page?
So hold on.
Can
so
you go back to page 35? Can we look at this?
Before we head down. Okay. So again, like I said, the language doesn't say legitimate societal objective, right? The language talks about the risk is of such a nature and degree that, considering the nature and purpose of the person's conduct and the circumstances known to a person, the person's conscious disregard of that risk is clearly blameworthy. I've done research earlier on this is very similar to the MPC language. Right? In fact, it's identical except for the clearly blameworthy is substituted for gross deviation from a reasonable standard of care. I've looked at MPC jurisdictions, their jury instructions, and what they do is they just repeat that language, right? Like, from what I've seen in the jury instructions. The point about legitimate societal objectives is just providing further explanation of what, you know, the sort of, it will be the rare case where you're talking about like this borderline sort of culpability or blameworthiness where you really need to get into those factors or, you know, could even be more likely an appellate court on review, right? Defendant's convicted and then the DCCA is trying to decide whether as a matter of law the juror, like a reasonable juror, could have found it. And then this is helpful information for them to analyze it, right? I don't think it's necessarily the case that anything that would be helpful, indeed essential, for an appellate court to execute its function has to go into a jury instruction, right? I mean, I think that's almost, it's almost definitely not the case. And which is partly why, right, we opted not to go more comprehensive in the statutory language codified here, right? I mean, we could have basically taken that multi-page commentary and codified it all. But I don't think you want that, because I think in most cases, this is sufficient. And, you know, I'll tell you, in years of reading recklessness cases, I don't think I've come across one where, you know, the sort of like fundamental issue is just, you know, kind of like that the government didn't carry its kind of like detached, unrelated burden of proving the absence of something like a legitimate societal objective. You know, that's just not how these things play out. That said, if there are tweaks or to particularly the jury instructions, you know, like by all means, you should go ahead and do that, right? Like the idea here is not to disrupt normal prosecutions, but the sort of the most celebrated part of everything the Model Penal Code did is their definitions of recklessness and negligence. Indeed, the DCCA routinely cites to it, and you know, I think in the most, particularly in the most recent case law, and you know, no one's ever raising administrability concerns with these types of definitions. So,
I think it'll play out in lots of different ways. In many circumstances, it's not. In a lot of cases, it's not going to matter, because my argument's going to be like, that wasn't me in the car. Whatever, the person ran and you stopped me, and I'm not the one who ran from the car. Where it matters, one, in the same way that people argue what reasonable doubt means and they explain it to the jury, they'll be that. In the same way that we have a separate instruction that, for example, explains what circumstantial and direct evidence is and talks about, like, it's raining, I see it raining, I see people with umbrellas, I wake up, the ground is wet, you know, all that. Like, there may be some really, Red Book may end up coming up with some really clear, stark, simple answers if there was going to be a separate instruction, because that you wanted standard in case it mattered what this meant, or the jury sent back a note saying, I still don't quite get it. And so we want to have if the jury sends that note, maybe you explain this. But the definition strikes me as probably included in the instruction, just what's there, how to define the mental state, and to the extent follow-up is needed, people are either arguing it in a way that the judge lets them, or the judge sort of says, that's not going to fly as a defense, because racing home for the football game, it does not make you not blameworthy. You're arguing it, or Red Book has come up with a sort of helpful explanatory instruction, if that ends up being necessary. But
well, and also let me just add to that, Dave, right, our definition of murder, definition of the mens rea of MDP, definition of the mens rea of arson, they're all malice. The DCCA definition of malice includes the absence of any form of excuse or justification, right? I mean, that, if anything, I think that's orders of magnitude more ambiguous and sort of like complex than take into account the person's purpose, you know, right? I mean, there are so many things that could potentially be justification, that could potentially be excuse, yet the jury instructions on murder, on MDP, on arson, don't feel the need to go further, and it doesn't appear to have caused the government, I mean, you can tell me if that's wrong, but that, you know, that the absence of justification excuse in these sort of, you know, core criminal offenses in the district has caused disruption as a dimension of culpability.
That's not an affirmative element you prove in every homicide, right? Like absence of mitigation.
Well, murder.
Right, but it's when there's evidence raised, but in the standard, someone just, you know, intentionally murders someone and there's no
or
evidence
MD, or MDP or MDP or arson.
We can move on.
Okay. Anyone else? Or any other?
Any grammar questions?
We can.
Not going to let it go, are you?
I was just trying to keep the conversation moving. This is our chance.
This
Richard's not here.
Yeah.
We ought to be, like, at least talking about him.
On the record?
I'm not afraid.
She's never cared about that microphone.
She didn't realize it was getting posted immediately.
Sorry, one other thing you about to say is, like, you know, causation, right? In any result element case, causation under current district law is going to be an element.
Mm-hmm.
And, right, the absence of causation, factual cause, proximate cause, I mean, you know, there's some complexity in there. But as far as I understand it, right, I mean, juries aren't actually getting, I guess this kind of goes to Laura's earlier point, juries aren't necessarily getting the full causation instruction in every single case where there's a result element. I think they're just getting the causation structure, that causation instruction when there's actually causation issues, right?
No, they get the full thing.
Do they? In every?
They don't not read the whole thing. Like in every homicide?
Right.
You get the whole thing.
Okay, so they read, right, in the same way that, for example, you'd read all the jury would get all the statutory language for the definition of recklessness.
Right.
But it's not like, you know, the causation instruction, it goes much beyond, like, the comments or whatever, goes farther than just, you know, it tells you what does reasonable foreseeability
right.
mean, et cetera, and the jury is not necessarily getting those sorts of details,
right.
you know?
You just get the instructional language.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. Is that it?
Okay.
All right.
Shortest meeting since I've been here.
It turns out Richard has been.
I guess so.
Thanks, everyone.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you,
everyone.
If you guys want to watch your hearing.
Yeah.